Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. The Let's Get Busy podcast is brought to you by All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in new ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com. Welcome to Let's Get Busy, a weekly podcast where I talk shopping and down to business with authors, illustrators, award winners, up-and-comers, and everyone in between. I'm Matthew Winner. This is episode number 215 of the podcast with Michael Arndt, author-illustrator of Cat Says Meow, an absolutely spectacularly designed picture book. Michael's work in graphic design and his temperance for working on images and text that lack excess is entirely impeccable. If you haven't had a chance to read Cat Says Meow yet, go find it and enjoy it, and then delve into this chat. And I hope you as well feel all of the crazy excitement and energy when you read it and think about it. It's really quite awesome. Here is episode number 215 of the podcast with Michael Arndt. Let's get busy. Welcome to the Let's Get Busy podcast, Michael Arndt. I am excited to talk to you tonight.
Thank you, Matthew. I'm not as excited as I am, I think.
That is crazy to know that, because I nerd out over your book all the time. You have seen this on social media.
I have, actually. Stop lying. People out there.
Yay. Point for me. I'm not a liar. Yay. Michael, so you have this great book that people hopefully are aware of listening. If not, I'm going to tell them, and hopefully they're going to be like, oh yeah, I've totally seen that book and I love it, because your book is called Cat Says Meow, Another Animalopoeia, and it's like a gorgeous, oh, listen to that, cat did say meow.
he is the title character, and he does say meow quite often.
But you've created this gorgeous design book. Or it feels like a design book to me. When I look at it, I feel like, oh my word, I am literally looking at art on the page, and I'm engaging in art. And when I think about children and their engagement in the arts, and a book like this that just makes you stop and investigate the art and look closer, it's so fun that you've created this and shared it with all of us.
Wow, Matthew, you get it. Not that I'm surprised, but I couldn't have written a better description myself in terms of what I put out there, what my goal was. That's exactly it. Thank you so much.
Well, this is me just speaking, Michael, from watching the children in my library and the children in my household look at this book. And it's one of those also, I should just say up front, that it's not a surprise to me that Chronicle published it, because it feels like a Chronicle book. It feels like that kind of a story. They have a way with valuing art and artists and making experiences in books like that. And so it's cool that you're part of the Chronicle family in that way. But more importantly, I think it's super fun too to see you on social media and to see that the story sort of goes beyond Cat Says Meow, that you continue to play with this format in other things. So it's fun to just see you as an artist and a designer play.
Thanks, Matthew. I'm glad you brought up Chronicle, because, first of all, their motto is "We see things differently." So that right away just made them appeal to me even more. And I don't, you'll probably be asking this later on, but I'll just jump in. They're the only ones I sent the book to. It's my first book, by the way. I'm total neophyte, or as I like to think, imposter.
I'm an imposter.
Yeah, just hiding in my sheep's costume amongst all the other wonderful illustrators out there.
You sent it to them?
I sent it to them, no agent. I just sent it to them. I had done a mock-up. There's a service called blurb.com. It's a wonderful service where you can upload your files and they send you an actual printed book, hardcover, with or without dust jacket, glossy or uncoated paper, any number of pages, custom done. You can just do one up for a fairly reasonable price considering it's just a one up. I think it cost me like $35, $40 to do a 32-page mock-up. And then I did send them a proposal as well to go along with it. I'm a graphic designer. I don't know if the audience knows that. So I'm kind of used to doing presentations. And I just sent it to them, and they're the only ones I sent it to. And the reason is because they're the ones I wanted to publish it. And I thought it was a chronicle book, but I think every author kind of says that or thinks that or hopes that. And luckily, they wrote back. One of the first things they wrote back was, this is a chronicle book. My editor said, we showed it in the meeting, and the design staff said, he's so chronicle. And that just made me beam from like left to right and back again and do somersaults. And yeah.
That's so awesome. I talked to Jeannie So, and I picture her at a meeting saying something like that, which is sort of wonderful to get to know the chronicle people and to have that connection now, knowing that that's how you approached it. And what a really smart way to do it too, to have the background and the experience that you have, to be able to create a mock-up and show them this is the way I picture it laying out. And this is, the way that I think it can be handled. Not that it didn't need to be edited or not, but, that you had that vision of the story, to that degree already.
That's exactly right. And I'm glad you brought up that as well, because, you know, like I said, I'm a neophyte and I'm a graphic designer. So I thought, okay, it's done. I present it the way I represent to the client. Not that a client ever accepts anything exactly how you present it. But I sent it and then they said, we like it, but I was like, wait, what's the but? And I'm like, well, no, it needs to be a little more kid friendly. We want to do a tweak here, a tweak there. Are you okay with that? And they wanted to really make sure that before we sign any things along dotted lines and stuff. And of course that made me nervous because I didn't know what territory I was getting into. But my editor assured me, we love the artwork and we're very respectful here at Chronicle of illustrators and designers and et cetera, et cetera. And I promise you, Michael, that that will be the case. And it absolutely was. It was really, really wonderful process. And the end product was, I think both sides were extremely pleased with it. You know, there are one or two things we butted heads on, and I gave in on some, they gave in on others. And at the end, we both said, oh my gosh, every decision that was made was the right decision. So it was a real learning process of what true collaboration looks like and can feel like. And it was great.
That's beautiful. Well, before I want to launch into sort of where this whole idea came from. I assume partly just from your designer brain playing around with shapes and letters and things like that. But would you mind sharing with the people listening just sort of how you describe Cat Says Meow to other people?
Well, it changes every time. I come up with it each time, some more elegant, some really botched descriptions. Basically, they're animals who look the same as they sound. So the letters and the sound of the animal are incorporated into the image of the animal. So it makes up the features, basically. And I really was striving to have that be the essence of it, that if there was any color or shape, they're almost incidental. They're almost just there because they just, the letters just needed a field or ground to sit on. And that's it. I wanted you to be able to take the letters away and just have a blob, almost like a lava lamp blob that was nondescript or just, I really started with a circle for most of them and said, how could I stray the least from this circle or this blob and just let the letters create the animal. In some cases, I had to stray fairly far because otherwise they didn't distinguish enough from each other. But yeah, that's basically it. And you're absolutely right. People are always looking for a really exciting story. And unfortunately, it's a very boring story how I came up with it. It's kind of the way graphic designers think. We are always sort of synthesizing word and image together, whether it's a logo or a layout in a magazine or a book or a poster design. We're trying to take meaning that's already inherent in the word, the printed word, and in images, whether photography or illustration, and hopefully combine them in a way that's succinct and efficient and elegant and meaningful and impactful and memorable. And in my case, minimal. I'm a big fan of minimalism for all those reasons. And so it's just the way I think after 25 years of doing this. I always think, how can I make the word and the image sort of meld into one entity?
Wow. I didn't even think about the way you're starting with just these blobs, these circles, and then going from there. That's absolutely right, though. That's probably what, again, makes it read so strongly, that it makes it very, very easy to see, to find the letters. It's not as if you're taking a drawing of a cat and sort of trying to work in the letters, like like some Highlights magazine, find the hidden picture, kind of, where have I hidden the M in this one? Where have I hidden whatever letters? But instead, it is driven by the letters. That, yes, I love that.
Thanks.
See, my brain was like enjoying that without even realizing that was what was going on. That's good design right there, Michael. That's good design.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so you're playing with it. This is just what happens. My word. Do you have like book ideas for 30 other books based on the same principle? Or are you sick of it yet?
No, I'm not sick of it. I'm like, I thought this would be a small, not a small idea, but I thought, okay, I'll give it a few years of work and then move on. And I'm realizing rather than get bored, I get more excited the more I work on it. I've been working on this, you know, as you know, the publishing process is a long process.
Oh, yeah.
I did this in about 3 months from April to June of 2011, proposed in July. I heard back the day before my birthday in September. Nice birthday present.
Yeah.
And my editor said, we're looking at spring 2014. I was like, 2014. I can't even count that far. I know it sounds so far, but I promise you it will fly by and before you know it. And it didn't totally fly by. The first year was kind of slow, and then it flew by, and before I knew it, it was out there. And now it's been 2 years, almost a year and a half. So yes, I do have several ideas that are, I don't know if you call them sequels, because as you know, there's really no narrative.
No, there's no narrative, right.
It's an early concept book. But I do have one that I'm working on based on wild animals. Because these are all basically animals. I grew up upstate, in upstate New York, in very kind of pastoral landscape with apple orchards and rolling hills. And these are all animals that were in my vicinity, in my kind of visual environment. Animals that would be familiar to a lot of people growing up here. So the other book is wild animals. I've got one I'm thinking about doing on just birds, because I know there are a lot of people just into birds.
Oh, yes.
And then I actually have a Halloween book that I previewed at some of the school visits I've done, and it's gotten a good reception. Halloween books, I know, as a librarian, you know this, kids, at least my other librarian friends tell me, kids love them. They kind of embrace them year round, not just at Halloween. I think from the publishing side, it's a little trickier sell because stores will only commit to it for a few weeks around, you know, for shelf space.
Oh yeah.
So once it's out there and sold, kids love it and they'll read it, whether it's Halloween or not. But trying to convince a publisher who then has to be responsible to the bookstores who have to, you know, dedicate shelf space to it. I do hope it gets published because it's a little different take on the whole thing.
Well, it reminds me of, I'm wondering if you're familiar with the books by, is it Sharon Sharon Werner, that might be it. Bugs by the Numbers, there's a dinosaur one, there's an animal one, where it's all, the illustrations are all made up of, in the Bugs one, they're all made up of a particular number repeated over and over and over, but all of those numbers sort of, when you pull back, make the shape of the bug. And then in the book itself, it ties to why the number is significant. In some cases, it's like the distance that different insects migrate or things like that, or the number of eggs that they have or something like that. Just where you're looking at illustration a different way, a non-traditional way. And that's what makes it interesting. They did, I think, three of those books. And so I think of the way that your story is doing that, and the way that I have to imagine when you're at school visits, that these illustrations are evocative for children of those moments when you want to pick up a pencil and try it yourself, when you want to play with the letters, manipulate letters around to try to make different things yourself. And so that's exciting to know that you are still playing in that world. And visiting schools and having those conversations, because I think that is one of the strongest appeals of Cat Says Meow, is that it caused me as a reader, and I know lots of other readers, to look at art and animals differently. It was a different angle to look at it, and it was one that is really sort of a treat for the eye to look at over and over, because it almost is a puzzle in the way that you're looking at it and finding the word in there.
That's very kind, Matthew. Thank you. I like to say that the letters, it kind of goes back to what we were saying earlier, the letters are hidden in plain sight, because on one hand, there's nothing else. There are no red herrings. They're not obscured. There's no extra letters in there to trick you. The letters are there, and that's all that's there other than the basic one singular shape and one solid color. And each animal, as you probably know, is a different color. I did that intentionally just to help give it a mnemonic device for the kids to say, oh, and also a different way to experience the book, you know, for parents or teachers or librarians that want to read it more than once, to say, okay, this time we're going to go through the colors, which... And maybe a memory game. Which animals were orange? Which animals were yellow? Which was the gray animal? Which animal began with the letter H? Or whose sound began with the letter H? Things like that. And if you take the letters away, like I said, there's one basic shape. So the letters really are the only things in there.
Yeah.
That said, I did, and to this day, I still thank Chronicle for having the insight and the courage, really, to produce this book. The fonts that I use are fairly sophisticated for the age range. The age range is, you know, officially 3 to 5 or 3 to 8. And I've got serif, I've got italic, I've got script, I've got things that, you know, I've heard that cursive is not being taught in some of the schools anymore. And yet there's script fonts in here. There are fonts that are partly blended into the shape of the animal. They're obviously negative shapes and positive shapes. So the kid, it's a challenge. The kid has to sort of see yellow one time and then white another time and go back and forth between positive and negative. And the turkey, for example, there's a really scripty E that's basically half there and half not there, because the rest is just absorbed into the white space. And I thought for sure they were going to say, oh, make that a Helvetica E and just make it like totally there. Because those are the type of things my clients used to tell me on what I would do, packaging and logos and layouts. And they did it. They kept it exactly the way I sent it to them. And I still marvel to this day that they were brave enough and sophisticated enough to do that. And because of that, what happens is it expands the age range. So there are babies who seem to like it because they're bold shapes and bright colors on white backgrounds, and they're big and they're high contrast. Little kids like it because they're animals and sounds. And then when I do, most of my school visits are K through 5, and I try to see every class. The fifth graders are the ones who actually get most excited about it, even though you'd think they were too old, because just for, like you said, that puzzle aspect, they're like, almost like a competition, like, do you see it? I see it. I see it first. I see them. I see the O. Oh, cool. Oh my God. Look at that one.
Oh, and yeah. I think with a fifth grader, the fifth grader doesn't even pay attention to your words. You have such plainly stated sentences. Goose says honk, turkey says gobble. And yet, that's not where my eyes go. My eyes, when you talk about that turkey, I think about how that cursive G looks. I mean, it looks like, you know, it looks like the turkey's head. And the, I mean, so like you can almost play, I'm losing my turkey anatomy vocabulary, but the
whatever it's called, I think it's called
the thing that hangs down from the turkey's mouth.
We should know this. We just came out of Thanksgiving,
but that thing, I don't eat the turkey's head. I don't know what it's called. Horrible. No, but to see that in, that's what I've had fun with when I show this to kids, is that I can say, so my favorite page, Michael, my favorite page is the frog. Frog says croak.
Because
that C is like a whipping tongue. And so it's so fun to be able to say, can you see the frog's tongue? And right away they're like, yeah, can you see whatever? And the children end up saying that they see different things. I have kids that have told me that in that capital A, that they see a back leg. That's the back leg sitting up. I'm like, that's great. When we have these discussions about illustration, the best thing is that I can't tell you if you're right or wrong. It's your interpretation of the illustration, which is great. And if you're interpreting it in a way that you're seeing the entire animal, then I like to share that you're probably thinking just like the artist did that made it. And so there's a lot of that that goes on too. And that's probably why it is so fun for the older kids to look at, because they start dissecting, you know, their mental image of the animal upside your illustration of the animal. And they're trying to like match the pieces to the animals. It's great.
Thank you. Thank you. That's, and for the kid who said it's the back leg, he was right.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, it has to be. But
multiple interpretations. But I saw it as a haunch and thigh and leg and, like, you know, their hindquarters, basically.
But it's a letter A. I mean, that's crazy. We're talking about a letter that we're reinterpreting as a body part. That idea, Michael, is insane. I love that. But it is crazy that is where your awesome graphic illustrator brain went, graphic design person. That's cool.
Okay, so it's good that we don't have video, because I'm blushing a lot right now.
Well, I mean, imagine like for kids doing this, and I'm sure this is probably how it plays out when you have your visits, but for kids doing this, you're starting with like a blob of color in some sort of shape. You were saying you kind of start with a circle-ish shape and then sort of adapt from there to whatever you feel like is absolutely necessary, the shape that absolutely is necessary. But you start with that, and then you're just adding letters. They're just letters. We see letters every single day, and we take for granted that we see them every single day in their different font displays. But that's all it is. It's just letters.
That's right. And I give them a little PDF projected presentation. And I take them through this exercise where I kind of basically explain to them, letters are just shapes at the end of the day. That's all they are. They're just shapes. Yes, on top of that, they represent sounds, which put together represent words, which represent meaning and syntax and all that. But typography, which is what graphic designers do, if there's one thing that unites all graphic designers, it's we all deal with typography. Typography is just really the shape, the visual reality of letters, which gets us back to why I've met so many librarians, is that, you know, at first you think graphic designers, librarians, what do they have in common? Well, it turns out a lot, because we both deal with the written word. We have to interpret it and put it down on paper and in a way that's clear and interesting and appropriate. And you do all the rest. So you do all the heavy lifting, but you bring it to life and you make sure that it enters the minds of people and the right people and at the right time. And And as I mentioned in the poster, why we love 10 reasons we love librarians, you're the guardians of this. You're the guardians of our collective knowledge. I mean, I don't think I'm waxing poetic or being too lofty when I say that. Every piece of information that's ever been known to mankind and ever will be is in your hands, basically, as librarians. So I just think that's awesome.
Well, you bring up that poster, and I think it's awesome that you made this amazing poster for, originally for, what was it, New York Public Library or somebody, right?
What did I do it for originally? No, actually, I just have, because one of the best unexpected surprises of having the book out there in the world is all the librarians I've met and become friends with and come to appreciate even more. And the very first public thing I did, I was invited to the New York Library Association section of school librarians, basically all the school librarians in New York State, their annual conference, to be in the author's alley and sign books and this and that. And through that, I just made a lot of great friends that I've kept in touch with and are on Facebook, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, there've been a lot of challenges, as you know, to the overall profession lately. And then it's especially in New York State with funding, and these are school librarians. So I just thought, how can I help them in their, you know, a lot of things were up for vote and the state sent in this and that. I was like, how can I help, kind of pitch in and help? And I thought that would it help to have an author, you know, say why librarians are great instead of just librarians trying to make their own case. And so I put together and I showed it to some of my friends and they liked it. So I said, what if I print these up and, you know, we can have them at the conference next year and this and that. And it just sort of went from there.
Well, I'm glad you did, because those are really important words and they do mean a lot coming from someone like you. Because I think that, I mean, I think it goes back to the same thing with being a teacher where you just hear people be like, yeah, yeah, we get it. You're underappreciated. Where, I don't know. It's not at all like any one of us in education, in librarianship, ever want to come across as being like complainy. But at the same time, it sometimes is hard to find the voice that connects with people. And sometimes it helps to call on friends and to have people like you that are strong advocates for libraries that are outside of the main library faculty, perhaps you could call it. So yeah, it's awesome. And you make pretty looking posters.
Thanks.
Yeah, it's all good. It's good. Oh, this partnership we all have, librarians and teachers with authors and illustrators, that's a good thing. I'm glad we're all buddies.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Totally does. Michael, it's been such a pleasure getting to talk to you tonight and to get to share how much I really do love Cat Says Meow and how much I really am excited and anticipating whatever you have that comes next. It's not often, I think, that a book just sort of sticks with you. And that first time I read Cat Says Meow, like you said, back in the beginning-ish of 2014, it just was a book that I have not stopped thinking about since. And I am positive people that have listened, or people that are listening now that have read that book as well, are going through the same feeling. So I think on behalf of all of us, I just wanted to say thank you for creating something that's so visually strong that it causes our own readers to tell their own stories and to want to interact and be designers just because of being inspired by the art that you committed to that page.
Wow, that blows me away, Matthew. Thank you.
Before I let you go, Michael, I'm going to ask you one more question about kickball. But I want you to know that regardless of whomever you say and regardless of wherever this conversation goes, even off recording, because I know we'll be continuing to be buddies on social media, that I really do value the way that you stand up for libraries and librarians. And I hope you know that things like that never, ever go unnoticed, that it means a ton to all of us. It really does.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, authors and books would be no place with librarians, without librarians. So you're more essential than I think most people realize.
I hope everyone listening that is in the library is hearing that as well then. All right, before we go, I'm assembling an all-star kid-lit dream team kickball tournament. And Michael, I would love to know what one person you want on your team, alive or past, from the kid-lit world, and why.
Okay, Matthew. So as you know, I've listened to a lot of your podcasts, so I kind of knew this was coming. But what I've never heard is, who are we playing against? Who's on the other team?
I suppose I've been making lots and lots and lots of individual teams to pitch you all against each other.
So is this competitive? Are we playing to win? Are we playing for fun? Because I have two different answers depending on how you answer that.
Ooh.
Competitive, it's for fun.
Let's say that it's for fun, but it's totally going to get competitive because the people in this wonderful kidlit world, if I'm any judge of myself included, are going to make it competitive at some point. So I would love to hear both.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to tell you both. So if it were competitive, I'm going to pick Maurice Sendak. And the reason is, from what I've heard, he was kind of a grouchy character. Didn't even particularly like kids. So I just feel like he would be a no holds barred kind of just go for the win, kick it as hard as he could. Be that competitive spirit. So that's if we're,
that's a good one. I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So now if it's just for personal satisfaction and getting to meet my heroes, it would be Dr. Seuss, hands down. Can you imagine meeting him and,
no, just, I can't imagine at all.
Or see what outfit he shows up in, or how he kicks the ball and does curly cues in the air, and like, you know, and what he says as he like runs around the bases. I just think it'd be hoop to meet him and just be able to pick his brain for a little bit.
I love the notion that Dr. Seuss could affect the ball in such a way that it doesn't just like go straight somewhere, but has its own character in the air as it's flying. That's great.
Oh, of course it would. Yeah. It could be no other way.
That's fantastic. Well, Michael, thank you again just for everything. Thank you for being you and for sharing your unique vision of the world with all of us.
Well, thank you, Matthew.
Let's Get Busy is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland, and by All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the books at allthewonders.com. Our theme music is by Blue Ducks. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referenced. Listeners, there are a ton of great episodes of Let's Get Busy archived and waiting for you at lgbpodcast.blogspot.com. And if this episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment on the blog or rate Let's Get Busy on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing the podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that is a very good thing indeed. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's Koko Sleep, and I'll see you there.